This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, with the bushfire crisis likely to push food prices higher, pressure mounts on supermarkets to give farmers a fair go.
One of the reasons why Australian farmers lack resilience in the face of this drought and indeed now these bushfires is the lack of competition, you know, in the domestic food space.
And buy bush, how entrepreneurial flair might help the communities devastated by this disaster. Rupert Murdoch's media empire is under attack over its coverage of climate change issues, and it's coming from within his own family. Son James Murdoch, who sits on the board of News Corporation, has accused the outlets of ongoing denial about the issue, pointing to what he calls the obvious evidence to the contrary as bushfires continue to burn in Australia. Isabel Rowe reports.
The views of climate change sceptics often find their way onto News Corporation's newspapers and television stations. But a senior member of the Murdoch family, the dominant force in the company, appears to have broken ranks. In a short statement to US online newspaper The Daily Beast, James Murdoch and his wife Catherine have offered a sharp rebuke of News Corporation's coverage of climate change.
Catherine and James's views on climate are well established, and their frustration with some of the News Corp and Fox coverage of the topic is also well known. They are particularly disappointed with the ongoing denial among the news outlets in Australia, given obvious evidence to the contrary.
The younger son of Rupert Murdoch, who is also on the News Corporation board, has talked about the dangers of climate change before, but his criticism of News Corporation's editorial direction has surprised commentators like Margaret Simons.
To come out directly criticising the newspapers run by the company, he still sits on the board of the company, is quite a notable move.
Margaret Simons is a writer and former journalism academic who's written about the Murdoch family. She says while James Murdoch doesn't directly run the company, his view holds weight. News Corp owns about 140 mastheads in Australia and publishes regular columns from commentators who reject climate science and its link to the bushfire crisis. It also owns the Fox News TV network in the United States, whose conservative commentators often ridicule climate change science.
You can't see, but it's deadlier than Godzilla and Vladimir Putin combined. It's global warming, and it's going to kill us all.
We cannot control the climate any more than they believed witches could control the climate.
These climate change alarmists have been wrong about just about everything. All of their charts have been debunked.
There is no man-made climate change.
Some commentators, like Margaret Simons, believe business and not just ideology is driving News Corporation's climate scepticism.
All mainstream media organisations are struggling to find readers and to maintain their social position as credible and influential outlets. The News Corporation tabloids in particular are already challenged in terms of their readership and the circulation, both are declining fast. I think to continue to deny the science, to undermine the political moves that need to be made, will in the long term mean they find it even harder to be taken seriously on other matters, and they'll find it harder and harder to get credible and intelligent journalists to work for them.
If, as you say, there is a dwindling readership in all organisations, is it then fair to say that News Corp has such a large impact on the public debate in Australia?
I think it's a declining impact and has been for some time. But at a broader level, News Corporation is still so dominant. A number of states in Australia only have News Corporation newspapers. And what they choose to put into public debate more broadly affects what gets talked about in Australia and the climate of politics.
Former News Corporation journalist Tony Kosh is highly critical of his former employer's coverage of climate issues.
It needed to be said. I think their attitude is coming from higher up. I think it's got to shake the conscience of Rupert for him to put out an instruction to say, you know, boys, stop the nonsense. You know, get real. Let's start telling the truth.
When contacted by AM, a spokesman for News Corp says he didn't expect the organisation would respond to James Murdoch's comments, but he referred to an editorial published in the Australian newspaper last week defending its coverage of the bushfires, which read,
In our coverage, the Australian's journalists report facts about how to tackle bushfires and about how to deal with the impact of climate change. Second, we host debates reflecting the political division that exists in Australia about how to address climate change without destroying our economy.
James Murdoch runs his own investment business and isn't otherwise employed by his father's businesses. Margaret Simons is interested to see how his comments are received.
News Corporation's internal culture is a very powerful thing and has proved itself very resilient to change in the past. So it will be interesting to watch what happens.
Writer and media analyst Margaret Simons ending that report from Isabel Rowe, with additional reporting by David Sparks. Well, the critique from James Murdoch comes as a federal government minister, Karen Andrews, offers her own blunt assessment about the debate over climate change. As the federal government convenes a roundtable of top scientists today to discuss the response to the bushfire crisis, the Minister for Science, Karen Andrews, says those who are debating whether climate change is real are wasting time.
Because every second that we spend talking about whether or not the climate is changing is a second that we are not spending on looking at adaptation, mitigation strategies. It really is time for everyone to move on and to look at what we're going to do.
Science Minister Karen Andrews speaking on RN Breakfast. Well, more help is on the way for the communities devastated by this year's bushfires. The federal government is funnelling $50 million to several charities so they can help people pay for food, clothing, petrol and other essentials. The money's coming out of the government's $2 billion bushfire recovery fund. And we'll hear more from the Minister for Government Services, Stuart Roberts, soon. Meanwhile, as the extent of livestock and crop losses becomes clearer, so too is the impact on the country's food supply chain. Industry bodies are warning that the prices of veggies could go up by 50%, and the federal government is heaping pressure on retailers to pass on any price rise to struggling farmers. Gavin Coote reports.
Agricultural consultant Sam Patton's been frantically fielding calls from clients who've been hit by the bushfires, among them a major orchardist in Batlow, the now fire-ravaged apple-growing district in southern New South Wales.
They were impacted with about 1,000 trees in their orchard, which interestingly, you know, growing high-value crops like pink lady apples and all these boutique varieties, that can mean potentially millions of dollars.
And there are fears livestock losses from the bushfires across the country could well exceed 100,000. The federal government is warning Australians will have to pay more for their red meat and fruits. The price of vegetables could also rise by up to 50%, with the peak body, AusVeg, counting the cost of the extensive crop losses and highway shutdowns. Sam Patton, who's worked as a bushfire assessor and valuer for 35 years, worries the fires could have decimated an already fragile supply chain in some areas.
And graziers producing either wool or lambs or beef were already heavily impacted by drought. So the last thing they needed was a fire, of course. The supply side was already being impacted, but you would never underestimate the overall regional impact on local abattoirs and stock selling agencies of the massive loss of livestock in this. It's a tragedy. If you've had thousands of stock destroyed in a particular region and possibly even infrastructure like selling yards and that sort of thing, it calls up the question of, you know, how do you recover from that?
Part of the federal government's recovery effort has been to provide grants for fire-affected primary producers and also to step up pressure on supermarkets. The Agriculture Minister, Bridget McKenzie, wants the retailers to pass on any price rises to farmers. New South Wales Farmers President James Jackson thinks the government's tough talk is warranted.
You know, I think the supermarkets are starting to understand that their position is untenable. I mean, we've seen these offers essentially been shamed into giving price rises to the milk industry, you know, the dairy sector.
And in these farming-dependent regions, there are lingering concerns about the knock-on effect of the fires on small business. The Small Business Minister, Michaela Cash, will soon announce extra support measures after holding an industry roundtable in Canberra yesterday. Almost all of Labor MP Fiona Phillips' electorate has been affected by bushfires, which have had a major toll on the local dairy sector.
The New South Wales South Coast there's no doubt, is in an unfolding economic crisis, and the government has to act now.
In a statement, Woolworths says it's actively monitoring the bushfires' impacts on the fresh food supply chain and would be happy to discuss ways it can support farmers if they've been affected. Coles says it's been making extra payments to directly contracted dairy farmers to help them meet their costs as a result of the drought, but that none of the farmers in Victoria and New South Wales have so far been directly affected by the fires.
Kevin Coote reporting. Well, as we mentioned earlier, some of Australia's biggest charities are being given $50 million to help bushfire victims pay for essentials like food and petrol. The Minister for Government Services is Stuart Robert. He's visiting the government's mobile service teams in Murrimbula, Bega and Eden today. And when I spoke to him earlier, I began by asking how the money will be distributed.
Through our existing partners, so we right now have over $40 million per annum through over 180 organisations across Australia for relief payments and $13.5 million for financial counselling. So we've got existing providers in place. So this is a $50 million package just for the bushfire ravaged communities across Australia, a massive injection, and we'll be using those partner agencies in many ways for relief, primarily through St Vinny's and the Salvation Army, since they have an extensive footprint across those bushfire affected areas.
The government's also been giving $1,000 per adult and $400 per child as a disaster relief payment. Now, the Australian Council of Social Service says that's seriously inadequate. They want it raised to $3,000, for example, for every adult. Would you consider that?
Remember, that disaster relief payment is designed for immediate release for those in very difficult circumstances, immediate relief. In many respects, when people call on the phone, we've had over 62,000 calls to our lines. We've processed over $42 million to 32,000 Australians. In many cases, they've got it in 5 minutes through the new payments platform. So it's immediate money that's going immediately to Australians, $1,000 for every Australian adult, 16 and over, and $400 per child.
Nonetheless, so ACOS is saying, look, that payment has been pegged at the same amount for 14 years. And is it not time to change?
Well, it's only one of the various payments that government provides, not just federal but state, and it's designed as an immediate relief payment. That's the whole point of it. It's quick. There's also the disaster recovery allowance for those who can't find access to their job because their job's no longer there or they can't actually get there. There's payments from states and territories as well. So it's only one of a series of payments that goes across people in very difficult circumstances.
You mentioned the disaster recovery allowance. That's the 13 weeks of income support. As I understand it, it's pegged to Newstart, which is $40 a day. Again, when people have lost everything, is that really enough?
But again, it's designed as a relief payment. So if someone can't get to their work, it's designed as an immediate relief payment on top of everything else that governments provide.
Are casual workers eligible? Because we heard on the program yesterday from one restaurant owner saying, look, high school students, for example, haven't had any summer work. Are people who've lost shifts or simply not being taken on, are they eligible for any of this income support?
They are. If you have lost your work and you just need to show the work you've lost, you can apply for disaster recovery allowance. It doesn't matter in the manner in which you're employed. It's just simply to say if you're no longer working, you can provide or you can seek support. Now, if you're only doing a four-hour shift once a week, you can't apply, of course, for the full Newstart package. But the point is there, it's to replace degrees of lost income for those whose workplace is no longer there. If you're working in an orchard for 5 days a week and the orchard, unfortunately, is destroyed, that's what the DRA is there for.
On climate change, your ministerial colleague Karen Andrews is being pretty blunt today. She says people debating whether climate change is real are wasting time, time that could be spent tackling the issue. Isn't that a message aimed squarely at the coalition party room, the government itself?
Well, government's policy on this is well known, that climate change is an issue we are dealing with every single day. It's well understood. The government's policies on this are well understood. We have agreed to a 26% reduction on our emissions, and we will hit that at a canter. We are absolutely and utterly forward-leaning into this policy program.
Well, you say it's well understood. You say it's well understood, yet one of your fellow Queenslanders, George Christensen, for example, he was recently rejecting the notion that climate change had anything to do with the bushfires.
The government couldn't be clearer on its commitment to dealing with climate change. Could not be clearer.
So he's out of step. Is he the only one?
Well, the government can't be clearer. I can't speak on behalf of individual backbenchers, but I can certainly echo the Prime Minister's words, and he speaks on behalf of the government, that we're dealing with climate change, we're dealing with it sensibly. We'll hit our Kyoto targets by well over 400 million tonnes. We'll launch into our Paris commitments, and the government has a very strong forward-leaning agenda in the climate change space.
Do you think the government should increase its emissions reduction target?
Well, government has set its emission reduction target at the Paris Climate Change Treaty.
Does the government need to aim higher?
Well, we set it in the middle pack of the nations of the world. We're only 1.3% of emissions, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do some heavy lifting, and we are. We're one of only a few countries that met our original Kyoto targets, which is impressive. And we'll meet our energy reduction targets as part of Paris years and years in advance. We've got a very, very strong track record on this and a very strong set of targets.
Minister, thank you very much for joining AM.
Great to talk to you.
That is the Minister for Government Services, Stuart Robert. You're listening to AM, where it's 8:15. Iran says several arrests have been made over the downing of a Ukraine Airlines passenger jet. The nation's president, meanwhile, has distanced himself from the initial cover-up that an Iranian missile had shot down the plane, killing all 176 people on board. His Middle East correspondent, Adam Harvey.
The outrage continues in Iran over the shooting down of Ukraine Airlines Flight 752 and over the lies that followed. The nation's leaders clearly want to show that they're finally doing something. Golhossein Esmaili speaks for Iran's judiciary. Some people have been arrested and the case is in its preliminary stages. Around 72 hours have passed from the moment we started our judicial work. Iran has so far focused blame on a Revolutionary Guards missile defence unit that misidentified the passenger plane as a cruise missile. It took 2 days for the government to admit what had happened. At first, Iran blamed mechanical issues until it became obvious that an anti-aircraft missile had hit the plane. Protests in Tehran and other cities that began on Saturday night have focused on the regime's lies. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has come out to say the cover-up wasn't his fault. As soon as I discovered the crash was not normal and ordinary, I put in a lot of effort to shorten the investigation so that we know exactly how the plane crashed. It was a very painful and unforgivable error, and I immediately ordered the people in charge to inform the people. He said those responsible will be punished and has implied there may even be some kind of open trial. The judiciary should form a special court with a high-ranking judge and tens of experts. This is not an ordinary case. All the world will be watching this case of ours. At least 30 protesters have so far been arrested, which is fairly tolerant by Iranian standards. Crackdowns on anti-government protests in November killed an estimated 1,500 people. Iran's leaders are also under pressure over the nation's abandonment of a key part of the nuclear deal with the West. European nations say they'll consider ditching the deal entirely and crafting a new, broader one that focuses not just on Iran's nuclear ambitions, but also on its aggression in the Middle East, in nations like Iraq, Syria and Yemen. UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab defended accusations that he's blindly following the lead of the US president.
In fact, it's not just President Trump, but also President Macron, who have argued for a broader deal with Iran, which first of all addresses some of the defects in the JCPOA, which is not a perfect deal, but is, in our view, the best deal we've got on the table as of now. And secondly, would address the wider concerns that the US and many other states, including the United Kingdom, have about Iran's broader destabilising activities in the region.
Iran announced it was abandoning limitations on uranium enrichment after the US killed its top general, Qasem Soleimani. This is Adam Harvey in Beirut for AM.
There was no scandal and no pressure, but the Premier of Tasmania, Will Hodgman, has suddenly resigned. He says he only made the decision in the last day or two and doesn't know what he's going to do next. But as Felicity Ogilvie reports, the race is now on to sort out who'll replace him.
It is the resignation that no one saw coming.
I'm really happy that the Premier's resigned. I think that the damage that he's done to Tasmania as a whole has just been utterly disgraceful, somewhere between the absolute shambles of our public health system and what he's done to the environment.
Quite indifferent, I'm not surprised. Another day at Australian politics, isn't it?
I think it'd be great to have a change after the housing crisis, which is getting... has become worse in the last 3-4 years and just proceeds to get worse.
Well, I'd like to know why he has done this so suddenly and look forward to seeing what happens next.
After 6 years as Premier and leading the Liberals to 2 state election wins, Will Hodgman is quitting Parliament.
I've given this job, which is an enormous honour and a privilege, absolutely everything. And it's a job I've loved. It's undeniable that it's had an impact on my family, and I want to thank them for their amazing support for the 17 and a half years that I have been a Member of Parliament, our children's whole lives.
Liberal Party sources say the new leader is likely to be the former Health Minister Michael Ferguson or the Treasurer Peter Gutwin. The Deputy Premier Jeremy Rockcliffe is also in with a chance. All three men are from the north of the state, something political analyst Kevin Bonham says will be beneficial to the Liberals.
In a way, it makes a lot of sense because elections are quite often won and lost in performance in the northern or partly northern seats. So it's not so unusual in that sense.
Can the Liberals go a third term?
You can't rule these things out, but there are going to be challenges for them at the next election.
The new Premier will be decided when Liberal MPs meet next week. Will Hodgman is a third-generation politician. Both his father and grandfather were also MPs. Now, the former lawyer needs to find a new job.
I have no job to go to. I've always said... that I would give this job 100%, and I wouldn't be doing so if I was thinking about what my next one might be. But I am looking forward to becoming financially independent.
The Labor opposition and Greens didn't want to do interviews, but they said they wish the Premier well in whatever it is that he's going to do now.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting. Well, during this bushfire emergency, thousands of people have had to suddenly flee their homes. The stress of the situation is compounded for families of children with disabilities, such as autism, who may have had to leave behind a specific item needed to care for their kids. Now, an online appeal has been launched to find special toys and other supports that might help ease some of that distress, as Matthew Doran reports.
We've all seen the images of Australians picking through the charred remains of houses, razed to the ground by the ferocious summertime inferno. Fighting back tears as they remember the good times and what were once their homes, they might come across belongings left amazingly untouched. A teacup, a photo frame, a toy. While many of these hold sentimental value, imagine what it's like when that item is the most important thing in the life of their child.
Children with autism like to have that certainty and they like to have things that they know.
Liberal Senator Holly Hughes has first-hand experience. Her son Fred was diagnosed with autism a few years back, and she's trying to help other families who have children with autism.
And obviously if you had to leave in a hurry, and I was talking to a family just this morning who had to get out in a very, very big hurry, if you've got something that's particularly special to that child, it might not have been something you were able to grab on the way out the door.
Sensory toys are often used for children with autism to focus and calm them. They could be a specific thing a child has an affinity with, such as a Thomas the Tank Engine train set, or even a more general item, such as noise-cancelling headphones. Senator Hughes has launched an online appeal, asking people to get in touch with her office if they need help replacing items left behind or lost during the bushfire crisis.
Because every child with autism is different, and we don't want to try and second-guess what it is that you might need, but that you can let us know.
She says the response so far has been heartwarming, including from corporate Australia.
A lot of promotional material are actually really good sensory toys. So those stress balls, fidget spinners, those sorts of things that people tend to put in conference bags or out of promotional tools, they're actually great sensory seeking tools for kids with autism. And I've also had grandmas and mums of kids with autism in Brisbane have reached out who are currently making weighted blankets.
While replacing lost belongings is important, so too is explaining to people with autism or communication disabilities what's actually happened.
For example, the smoke. And what does the smoke mean? And why might you need to wear a mask? And why does that mean you can't play outside today?
Professor Bronwyn Hemsley is the head of speech pathology at the University of Technology, Sydney.
They might not be able to understand what's coming through on the radio or the TV. They might need extra communication supports.
She says a tool often used is called a social story.
So visual supports, that is pictures in a sequence, explaining what's happening or what will happen, and helping to reassure the person about what to do and that they're safe.
Senator Hughes's online appeal has also taken into account people needing help developing those tools through speech pathologists like Professor Hemsley.
So it's not about everyone working in silos. It's not about people doing their own thing. It's about everyone trying to work together and pointing people in directions where we can and who can help and who's best placed to help.
New South Wales Senator Holly Hughes ending Matthew Doran's report. Well, as many regional communities strive to recover from the bushfire emergency, they might get a few tips from the Buy from the Bush campaign that really took off over recent months. It encourages people in the city to buy online from regional businesses in areas hit hard by the drought, and it was flooded with interest in the lead up to Christmas. But can the momentum continue? Alexandra Beach reports.
Grace Brennan is still amazed at the level of support for her social media campaign. From her base near Dubbo in central western New South Wales, she kept expecting demand for Buy from the Bush to die off as Christmas got closer, but it never happened.
Yeah, the feedback from the business is that it's still been quite overwhelming, the response, which is so cool.
Buy from the Bush uses social media to connect city buyers with small businesses in drought-stricken communities. Since launching in October, it's racked up more than 165,000 followers on Instagram. Grace Brennan's expecting a bit of a lull in January, but she's still optimistic about the year ahead.
Well, hopefully people have discovered beautiful things and beautiful businesses, and it's just a matter of hopefully converting them into customers for life. You know, if they're following individual Instagram feeds or social media accounts and they can keep connecting with those bush businesses for a lot longer, then I suppose the benefits will be long term, which is what we're hoping.
Stephen Dan is a senior lecturer specialising in marketing, social media and consumer behaviour at the Australian National University. He says part of the reason Buy from the Bush is such a success is that it takes a much smarter approach than standard charity.
Charity is a case of, I'm going to give you the money, I'm not expecting anything back. But charity frequently causes problems where it buys out supplies that people had budgeted for. So when we did the big hay bales for farmers, the farmers who'd set aside their money to buy the hay bales were suddenly priced out of the market by the charities buying up the resources that they were then giving away to someone else, giving away to the competitor. Here, we're doing it as we're treating you like us being any other customer.
But Dr. Dan says the campaign's long-term success is more complicated, and sales could potentially drop off after the Christmas rush.
Christmas is the big spike time for retailing, so there's a little extra incentive. It's down to how well the products do their job. If you bought from their bush, you've had a good service, the people have sent you the stuff, just like any other shopping experience. But also, if the things that you buy from there are things that you're going to need to buy again.
He says certain types of businesses may be better placed to continue to thrive on the platform, like those selling clothes or second-hand items, or offering something specific to their region.
If your strength is being able to provide something that you can only get one particular patch of Australia, then you've got a long-term opportunity. But if you're trying to sell things that, you know, we could as easily get down at the corner store, you're basically not going to win that. I think value for money is going to be the biggest challenge. And at the end of the day, we're still asking these stores to be shops, and we're buying from them because they've got something we want to buy. If we're buying from them because we feel a bit sorry and, you know, here's $5 for something we're not going to use, well, Marie Kondo would tell you it's a bad idea to go down that path. If it's not sparking joy, don't buy it in the first place.
But campaign founder Grace Brennan's not worried and says new opportunities are being sought to sustain the campaign in 2020.
Hopefully in January we'll get some things happening for back-to-school items, and we'll be focusing on various holidays throughout the year, so keep your eyes peeled for that. But just more generally, I mean, most of the stuff that we're featuring isn't Christmas specific. Lots of fashion, lots of homewares. Obviously, the drought will not be over after Christmas, and the impacts of this drought will last long after it rains. So the more we can think to expanding that consumption beyond, you know, the kind of city bubble or beyond your local solutions, the better for bush business.
Grace Brennan from the Buy From The Bush campaign, ending that report from Alexandra Beach. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.